Good afternoon.
We're all awake.
This is excellent. Hi, my name is Dr. Nicole Kirk, and I'm the Frank and Alice Schulman Professor of Unitarian Universalist History at Meadville Lombard Theological School in Chicago. And I am here with my two colleagues, also from Meadville Lombard, Claudia Espinel and John Leaker, who will be introducing their titles, because sometimes we have long titles like mine. So they'll be introducing themselves when they come up to speak. But first of all, I just, again, wanted to welcome you to our Empowering Memories Oral History Workshop and to invite you all to think with us together and to learn some best practices about oral history. This has been an amazing General Assembly, and we have been doing so much work around anti-racism, anti-oppression, talking about how we can do that work together. But history actually is an act of social justice, if done well. And a lot of the times, that kind of history is about recovery. And so it's recovering the voices that have been erased, the voices that have been silenced, the voices that have been forgotten. And so one of the ways to get at that is oral history. And so that's what we're going to be exploring with you all today. And this is something that we, the three of us, care very deeply about, because history informs our work. And some of you may know Denny Davidoff, you know, you've seen her around, maybe hopefully answered her Service of the Living Tradition call, former moderator. She's also at Meadville Lombard, and she talks to me all the time, and also John, who works in our leader in our archives. She talks to me about how challenging it is in so much of the work as Unitarian Universalist, and a lot of that challenges are due to the fact that we don't know our history. And as a historian, I absolutely agree with her, but I love hearing from this amazing lay leader who has been with us for so long, and that she gets that as well. And so that's what we're going to explore. It's going to be interactive. Don't worry. Or it'll be okay if you do worry about it. It'll be fun. And I am going to now turn over, to no further ado, to Claudia Espinel.
I'm your target when I am, so. Hello, everyone. Thank you for being here. In 2015, the Unitarian Church of Burundi was targeted by the Burundian government. The congregation was attacked.
Can you speak into the speaker a little more?
Here?
You don't have to get up. You just speak
here.
Right in front of it.
Yeah. Oh, Thank you. The congregation was attacked, and its minister was held in custody, kidnapped by the government. Because the Unitarians in Burundi are really strong on social justice. The government was feeling threatened by them. One of the first things that the government took was the minister's computer. And in the minister's computer was the whole history of the Burundian church. At that moment, they lost all the written history they had. Most of their leaders had to flee the country. The minister was kidnapped for about 9 days, and right after he was out of prison, he left the country, and now we are working with him. They have decided and they want to recover their history. They don't want to let the government destroy the work they have been doing. They want to retell how the Burundian church started, how Unitarians got to Burundi. And even though he's not in the country anymore, he is working together with members of the congregation, of his congregation, still living in Burundi, living in Rwanda, living in the U.S. and Canada, to put oral history together. So with Meadville Lombard Theological School, we are partnering with them. We are bringing the technical support so we can make sure the history is not lost. They are resisting the government by making sure the history is remembered, and they are using this as a tool to come together and to celebrate the fact that they are still alive, and they are still together, and that the Unitarian community got to Burundi and is still present in their community.
Okay. So So Claudia just gave us an example of how, in a very dramatic way, history can be, in this case, stolen away, and thus has the risk for being silenced. But it happens in a lot more subtle ways, too. How many people are maybe some historians in your congregation or archivists? Do we have any of those kind of folks here? You don't have to be. It's an open, sort of. Okay, actually, so not as many. That's interesting. And so every year at Meadville Lombard, I have our students do a history of the congregation that they're connected to. And a fascinating thing happens, and there's several levels to that history. So I have them do a survey. How is the history told? And the usual first wave of information comes back from my students is that, well, the history is a list of ministers. Sound familiar? And by the way, they often don't list all the ministers. They might leave off the interim ministers, or I've actually seen this, the ministers they don't like. And so they don't, and as if that's the history of a congregation. And then there's the other part, is that if they have a little bit more, most often it is a list of the buildings. Where they rented, what burned down, what they rebuilt, where they moved to when they had a mass of the population who were members of the congregation in a different place. And then another part of the history, if there's a little bit more, can often be focused on just one period of the history of the congregation. Some of you may have heard about it in your congregation. It's called the glory days, right? The good old days. Well, when such and such was minister and such was here, and it's the glory days. But history is a lot more complicated and rich and wonderful in our congregations than just a listing of buildings and ministers. And in fact, ministers come and go, buildings come and go. A congregation is the people, and we so often miss those voices. Here's another example of history. This comes from a congregation before my doctoral studies. I served as a parish minister for a congregation outside of Cleveland. And this is a little bit of their history. It talks about six people who gathered in a living room of Lincoln and Carol Christensen's home in Minner, Ohio, and a growing Cleveland suburb at the time, to discuss the idea of starting a Unitarian church. It was February 1956. Ohio was rapidly growing in the post-war boom. Chemical companies, manufacturing companies were springing up all around Cleveland, and they were attracting scientists, mathematicians, engineers, chemist. Also, it's a time of population shift in Cleveland. It's growing incredibly fast, but also the population is changing about who's moving where in the suburbs and the inner city, and the dynamics around race and ethnicity has a lot of growing tension. The small towns surrounding Cleveland are growing, and so they're also attracting people as school teachers, workers for the shopping centers, the libraries, the parks, being built as quickly as possible, and lots of churches. But those gathered in the Christensen living room did not want to be Presbyterians or Methodist or even the liberal Disciples of Christ. They wanted to be Unitarian. And although there were other Unitarian churches in Cleveland, the eastern villages of Minner and Painesville and Chardon were more than 20 miles away from the nearest Unitarian Universalist church. And at that time, it was just Unitarian, mind you, at Shaker Heights. The group of six plotted a course forward, and they decided to put an advertisement in a local paper announcing a meeting to discern interest in liberal religion in Lake County and the desire to begin a Unitarian church. So it's like, hey, y'all, come on, and let's see if we want to start a church. Guess what? 20 people showed up at the meeting. By May of that year, they had applied and received fellowship status from the American Unitarian Association. And a few years later, the association would send for 6 months a minister at large, the Reverend Brant Butler, to help the fellowship grow. And it did. Now, that might seem like, okay, that's a lot more history than a list of ministers and the buildings. And yet, there is so much missing from that story I just told you. Who were these people? What did they say to attract the folks to become a part of that meeting in a living room? What was their theology? What was that first worship service like? What did they do? Who was at the table? Who was not at the table? What was going on in Cleveland, let alone Mentor, Ohio, in 1956? One of the things that we talk about in my history classes, and we also have a big emphasis in our archives, and John will be talking about this as well, is looking at the places where our history has the blank spots, the spaces where there are silences, where we have to look around the margins to bring those voices into the mix. And these projects of recovery really use a lot of the methods and the work of American religious historians that they started over 20 years ago, almost 30 years ago. And it was a movement to record, to talk about, to analyze what we call lived religion. So historically, we have done a very good job when we look at religious traditions and talking about the theology, what people say they believe, looking at the leaders, listing the ministers is one of the phenomena of that kind of point of view. But we don't talk about the members of the congregation and their practices, their habits of the mind, their habits of worship, their habits of the body, how they are in that space together, how they do different practices and rituals that may be different from the church down the street. We lose all that. It's not even in the annual report, right? Usually. And so how do you capture that? Historians started talking about that we know next to nothing about religion, how it's practiced. And that there's a serious disconnect, and I think this is one of the themes of GA this year as well, is that there's what you say you do, and then there's what you actually do. And so when you just talk about a religious tradition or a church's or congregation or fellowship's history, if it is only focused on a list of ministers and the buildings, you are missing out on the practices of what people are doing, how they're living their religion, how they say their theology is XYZ, and how that is lived in their actions as a congregation. And so that history can be challenging to get at. Religion is messy, but we want to know about how a fellowship's culture or a congregation's culture is in action. So it's getting at that lived religion and drawing a more comprehensive map. This is what one historian says, drawing a more comprehensive map of practices over time. Practices that sometimes we have to remember are not isolated, that they're also a part of what's going on in the larger framework of the world. And with that, I turn over the mic to John Leaker.
Hello, I'm John. I'm the archivist at Meadville Lombard, and I like details. So I'm going to talk about how do you do an oral history. But I think we kind of, let's summarize what we have talked about. What can an oral history do? It can bring into the historical record experiences and identities that would otherwise be undocumented. It ensures that the historical record of your congregation reflects the lived experience of Unitarian Universalism. It democratizes your history. Most of all, it helps you remember. It keeps alive tradition and rituals. It helps save the wisdom of elders. Oral histories create memories that everyone can see themselves in. It's not a panacea. An oral history doesn't correct every erasure and everything that's forgotten, but it's a good start. So my question to you is, what is an oral history? It's not a rhetorical question. How would you guys define oral history? You look like you're raising your hand, not to put any pressure on you.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else?
It's also in some older congregations, diaries.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
That can be looked at because particularly women, although I think men and women all very often kept journals or diaries, what we call diaries today. And some of those, if the church is old enough to have some of those, are extremely valuable.
Can you make
oh, sure. So your answer is, it is a recorded conversation out of people's mouths. And I know Mary Ella, so I can say her name. It is diaries and people's personal experiences that have been recorded. And I say, I think those are both accurate. But I think an oral history is also, there's something intentional about it, right? So an oral history is unique because unlike normal conversations or interviews or correspondence, they are a sustained exploration of an individual's personal experience and their reflections on the past. They're also intentional about the process. Oral histories are designed to create useful historical documents that have utility for the moment you create them and for generations into the future. It's a way of creating historical documents that live beyond the moment that creates them. They have enduring value, and they last. So, how do you do that? How do you create enduring value? How do you create an oral history? So I think the first thing you should ask are, what themes, events do you want to explore? What are the blank spots in your congregation? What are the things that are passing from living memory? What does the moment we find ourselves in call us to remember of the past? If you're going to be doing a series of interviews, if you want to kind of represent a historical period, are you ensuring everyone's experiences will be expressed? Are you being representative? This theme of intentionality is very important with oral histories. So you have a theme you want to explore. You have that. So what do you do next? You should familiarize yourself with the history as best you can. You don't want to go in blind. What events and experiences do you need to contextualize in your history? Also, you need to reflect upon yourself. How do your identities and privileges inform the oral history you will be giving? How does your privilege affect the dynamic? How does gender, race, class, and power impact you being the questioner? Are you the best person for the interview? A very typical example is a young adult interviewing a church elder. It's a very common experience, and it brings very fruitful interviews. But an elder interviewing an elder creates a different type of document. So you should be intentional and reflective upon who's doing the interviewing. So you have your theme, you have your person, you have your interviewer. What's next? And these are really basic but really important. You want someplace quiet with decent acoustics. So if you have a big old church, don't do it in the center of that. Find a nice quiet room. You want the best equipment you can have. It doesn't have to be expensive. I mean, a cell phone's a good start, but you want to make sure it works. You want to test it. You want to really make sure it works, because nothing is worse than an hour-long interview and you didn't press record or it wasn't picking up the audio. Sometimes you can also record Skype calls and use other forms of technology if people are dispersed at a distance. The Burundi example is a good way to think about that. Because if you want to get everybody's story, you have to reach out to everybody. And sometimes that requires going to them instead of them coming to you. So now you have your person, your theme, and your room. You also are going to want to get consent. It's just not enough to interview someone. The person you're interviewing needs to be informed of how it will be recorded, what topics will be addressed. The person needs to sign a document granting copyright to the repository that the history will be stored in. Because you want this to be of enduring value, researchers have to use it. So you have to lay the groundwork to make the oral history accessible. You also need to have a plan, so you do the oral history, where does it end up? How do you store it? How do you make it available? If you do an oral history, record it, and lock it in a filing cabinet, why did you do it at all? You want to get these out and accessible. Okay. So now you have your person, they're informed, you know what you're talking about, you have your quiet room. What questions do you ask? And this is really, really important. And this is something you want to do beforehand. So I would start with thinking of your questions chronologically. That's how people think. That's how people remember the past. So start from the beginning of the event or the theme or the dynamic you're exploring and walk the person you're interviewing through that process. You want to have a good balance between factual questions, when, where, and how, and questions about motivations or personal experience, the why, right? It's pretty easy to make a timeline of events, but the why is the question that's interesting, and why is a question that can inform us of so much. So balancing that helps give you a good historical record. It also puts the person being interviewed at ease, because they're not having to dig deep into their experience all the time. They're giving you a date or a time, and that back and forth helps the conversation become more natural. Also, so you create this nice list of questions, you also have to adapt. Ask follow-up questions. Let the interview organically grow, because if you just force this interview to be your perception of what you want to know and not what comes up, it creates a poorer historical document. That being said, you also want to stick within the boundaries that were agreed upon. As I mentioned before, having informed consent is so vital to making this process just. And you don't want to push somebody where they don't want to be pushed or where they haven't agreed upon. So that is kind of like the arc of having to navigate, going where the interview goes and getting good questions and answers, but also within the bounds of what you both agreed upon. And once again, to focus on personal experience, and I mean this, as you're conceptualizing these questions, understand you are getting one story out, not the story. That this is one person's personal experience. And as you conceptualize your questions and the approach, understand you're telling one story that's part of many other stories, never the definitive story. Once again, oral histories aren't a panacea. They don't fix every problem, but they do allow you to bring individuals' experience and perception into the record. Now I'm going to give you some UU-specific advice. Look towards lived religious experience. We love to remember our ideas. We love to remember our ministers and our buildings. We don't seem to want to remember or forget or don't think it's important, just the reality of going to church, of being in community. What does it feel like to be in beloved community? It's a wonderful topic to explore. I emphasize this. Also, don't center your questions around ministers unless there's a very good reason to. So if you have a long-time member, an elder, don't organize your questions. What did she do during the ministry of Jane Doe and then John Doe? Don't reproduce these kind of problematic ways we remember ourselves in your questioning. So you have your questions, you have your list all prepared up, you're ready to go. What do? You press record, never forget that. Always start by stating your name, the narrator's name, the date, the location, and the subjects that will be explored. This is useful for future researchers and in case any additional documentation is removed from the recording. Once again, you want this to be useful 50 years from now. And once again, start by asking your questions and start feeling out where the person you're interviewing wants to go and begin kind of that complicated dance. Conversation is a skill, and doing an oral history is a particular skill. So work on getting your questions, making sure the themes are being addressed, providing gentle direction, and don't be scared to gently push back. If the person is vague or a superficial answer, go back to it. If these are the themes that you both agreed to address, make sure you address them. At the same time, you want to create a safe space for the narrator. Some topics, even when agreed upon beforehand, can be traumatic. The interviewer needs to respect that and respect the narrator's right not to have to speak on some issues. It is best if this is worked out before the interview, but sometimes that doesn't come up into the interview itself. So be a sensitive, empathetic listener. So you have your interview. What do? You're done. You may need another session. That does happen. So it's best to immediately schedule another one when the person's right there while I kind of keep that momentum. When you prepare the document to sign over copyright, make sure both the interviewer and the narrator actually sign it, because you need to sign it as well. Because if only you have copyright, it's still not accessible to researchers. You want to have the copyright signed over to the church or to the archive you're donating it to, so it will be sustainably accessible into the future for researchers. Make sure the recording is usable. Right? Play it back, make sure it's clear, the whole thing was recorded, and finally back it up immediately. I'm paranoid about that. I email it to myself. I upload it to Dropbox. I put it on a thumb drive because this is work. You did all this work, and you don't want it to go away. And if you're going to be donating this to an archive or another repository, don't forget to send it off. Once again, if you do this oral history and it sits in a cabinet, why did you do it? They're meant to be usable for your community and for researchers now and into the future. So it takes time to do this. It's a process, and this is a very brief introduction. The handout has kind of a checklist, and if you go to the Oral History Association website, they have really good resources. There's a lot of great online resources to help you out. And it also takes practice. Your first oral history will be your worst oral history you do, I promise you. But it also gets better. And as you learn these skills, you can start bringing up these experiences and stories that were lost. You can start creating a beloved community that remembers all of its members. And as you think about conceptualizing your oral history project, you need to pay careful emphasis on what identities are you obscuring. Right? Our problem is historical records aren't neutral. Oral histories aren't neutral either, but the intentionality of the process can begin to help create a more just understanding of your congregation or your community's past.
Now we are... Okay, so now we are going to practice. We are going to do oral history here. We're going to start with something really simple. I'm going to explain the first exercise really quick. I will invite you to find someone, another person that you would like to interview and be interviewed by. And the first question is going to be an easy question just to warm up. You are going to tell each other how you became or how you were introduced to Unitarian Universalism. And each one of you is going to have 2 minutes to answer the question. 2 minutes, you don't need to speak all the 2 minutes, but you need to give the person the space of the 2 minutes. If there is silence, silence is powerful. Let's practice. If the person doesn't go all the 2 minutes, let's practice how it is to be quiet for a while. The person practice listening, active listening, be present for the other person. Don't try to interrupt. Let the other person tell the story. So find someone with whom you would like to pair up, and I will tell you when to start. Okay, so let's start. Okay.
Could you give the instructions one more time?
Okay, so that's fine. I can do that. So you're going to talk for 2 minutes. Each one of you is going to have 2 minutes. We are going to let you know when the 2 minutes are over. And the question you are going to answer is introduce yourself and tell the other person why you became or how were you introduced to Unitarian Universalism. Okay, we are going to start now.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's let the other person share their story. So two more minutes for the other part of the group to tell the story. Okay. Now we are going to go into deeper conversations. You are also going to have more time. So Nicole and John distributed the yellow papers. We have three questions there. The last one is pretty similar to the one we just did. So if you want to go deeper on your initial conversation, you can do it. Now you will have 7 minutes. Each one of you will have 7 minutes to answer the questions. We are going to make an introduction. We are going to give you an example of how it will work of our story that Nicole has herself, who can help you kind of think of the small details that you would like to share with your partner.
So for an example, on question one, what is an unrecorded or a meaningful ritual practice that you've experienced in your congregation or community? One of the things I was fascinated about when I arrived at East Shore in 1998 as a minister is that they had this croning ceremony that the women in the congregation, as a woman went through menopause, they had a celebration for her, and I started asking questions. Where did this come from? Cakes from the Queen of Heaven. There was a group of women who had done this fabulous curriculum. And then they developed the ritual, and it had this whole life of its own. Was it in the history? No. Was it recorded anywhere? No. And yet it was this dynamic, fantastic part of the life and history of the congregation. So that would be an example for one of those questions. Yeah, so unrecorded, yeah. So it's not in the official history. It's something that, again, may be overlooked because it's just something we do. That's often how things get missed. And so looking at trying to capture that in the conversation of this oral history.
Yeah. Yes, and one thing, too, as you just exercise, this is practicing asking questions, not telling stories, right? Because we're training to do oral histories.
Yeah.
So the exercise is directed at the person who will be asking the questions. So imagine, use the checklist that you have and think about asking good, open-ended questions and exploring that. So have fun. We will start the timer.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
Before you start, are we going to go through and do 1 and then at another exercise, do 2? Or do we have a choice of doing one of the three?
Pick one of the three. Yes, that is a great question. You'd be a good oral historian. Are there any other questions before we start? Okay, start. Yeah. Hello? So the first 7 minutes is up, so now we switch. So if you were the interviewer, you're now the one being interviewed. And we will start again, then we'll have questions after this about your experiences or any questions you have generally. So start.
I think that's how to my house.
7 minutes goes by quickly, or even 14, right? Right. I love the energy of your conversations. It was flowing up here, washing over us, and we were excited. So we're going to actually have a moment, or two, actually several moments, where we want to hear about the experience. And so a little bit of popcorn, so to speak, feedback on your experience or aha moment. If you're going to share something that's coming from your partner, it's probably best that they do it or you ask permission first is the best thing to do. So make sure you balance that. And let's see what we have out there. I see a hand already.
Well, I want to observe that it is very easy to drift into a conversation.
Yes.
And I would like to invite your feedback on the limits of that versus sticking to your initial focus.
I think there are many kinds of oral histories. It's not that a conversational one is worse, but it's different. So to be intentional about what are your ends, what are you imagining the document you want to create, what's the document that needs to be created, I would think a conversational approach is a tool in your toolbox for doing oral history. Because there's not one definitive version of an oral history. You interview somebody five times, you have five different documents. I think that's one of the beautiful things about it. But it is a good point, like if you're intending to have a more formal interview, or you have a lot to get through and it drifts in a conversation, that's probably less than ideal. But it can be something kind of beautiful that something comes out.
What I just want to have a follow-up and say that one of the dynamics that happened as she was telling her story is I was shocked by things and I was going, oh my gosh, that would never be that way in our congregation. and suddenly I'm in the conversation. Mm. My experience rather than keeping the focus on her experience.
Well, on the conversation part, as a historian, sometimes that can be one of the richest treasure troves of information because it does go in unexpected places and it brings up material that you might never find because it wasn't specific to the question. But as human beings, when we're talking, and some of us more than others, me sometimes. You ask me a question and I'll give you a lot of stuff over here. But for oral history and then later for someone like myself who's a historian, so like I'm finishing a book on John Wanamaker, the Philadelphia department store merchant prince, whenever I can find places where he's just going off talking about what's up in life, I'm like, yes, this is what I need. And I find those things that I'm looking for. And then John can add to that risk about the interviewer getting inserted too much in the process.
And the other thing is like, who is conversing? So a conversation between two people with an interesting dynamic could create a good document. So when I talked about, are you the right person for the interview? Think of your colleagues, your community, who's the best for the interview? Because sometimes a conversation between two people with similar or different experiences could create something very useful.
So one of the important things, one of the important skills is to develop the ability to ask curious questions. And when you ask curious questions, the focus is on the other person, is on learning about the other person experiences. And that's one of the tools that the skills that we need to develop in order to have rich oral history.
So I work as the podcast producer for my congregation in Madison, Wisconsin, and I've done a lot of interviews, but I haven't really done oral history focused interviews. And my question in particular is about when you do an oral history interview, like, are you, because you have to think about your audience, you have to think about who's going to be listening to this, and you're going to do, if you're going to do an interview that you know is just going to be put away in a library or an archive somewhere, even if it will be accessed by a researcher later, that's going to be a really different interview than if you do an interview that you know is going to go on SoundCloud or on your radio station or something like that. So I'm wondering if you have any comments about how to keep your audience in mind.
I think that's a very interesting question. And to kind of continue your what you were talking about is, if you imagine your audience as some like future dour academic researcher, it can really limit the conversation. That's a really good point. I would imagine that, one, a podcast interview could be a great historical primary source, right? It could be immensely useful. The difference was with an oral history, it's intentionally created for the future or for future researchers in a way that a podcast is created for the moment and thus documents that moment. So I think there's some definite overlap, but there's a difference. And I think about audiences, I wouldn't necessarily... The audience is the future, which is kind of a broad term, but I would really think your community knows itself. The knowledge is there. So I would trust your own judgment, and if you're having a committee or a team doing it, trust their judgment about what kind of audience you're imagining in the future. Because an oral history to remember your congregation, for your congregation, is a perfectly valid use. An oral history of your congregation for researchers is another good use. And you can do both, or try to do both together, but just being intentional and thoughtful.
Thanks, John. And so, just wow, Elizabeth, that's fantastic, the Madison congregation and the podcasting. So I just want to raise that up, by the way. You should do a workshop if you haven't already done that, because that's very exciting. And I say, I mean, so much of what historians look at are written or recorded with a specific audience in mind. And so that's part of a historian is understanding that, okay, that interview will be shaped by what is said and not said because of how it's being delivered in the podcast. So that's actually a part of the history, is that the audience, the format. But I think you can do a twofer there, as we would say, and that's totally legit. And that's just a piece of the puzzle. Yeah. There's a lot on this side of the room, but let's go. Am I missing any hands over there? Let's mix it up and we'll come back. Okay.
A small, short one. I noticed that really the homework as a listener was to have a question, but both of us had so much to say. Yeah. It became more of a discipline of letting go of what is my question and just listening.
Yeah, let me interject something here.
All right.
That I thought really interesting. I asked the question. I said, why was this important to your church? She said, why did you ask that question? And I said, because this is my interview. And then she answered the question.
But you bring up a fabulous piece, and this is one of the things we have a global international program at Meadville Lombard, and part of the pedagogical training for the faculty and staff is to think about, and we're working on this, is how do you engage with folks? And listening, Claudia tells us all the time, is such an important piece. So there's the curiosity, but you gotta listen. And sometimes, I don't know, Unitarian Universalists sometimes are already busy thinking about their answer or their comment about something that they don't, we sometimes fall down on that. And so that's a discipline that is really beautiful when you stay in it. So
now that we are starting to work with the Burundian community, one of the first interviews is going to be John is going to interview one of the members of the community, just as a way of making them comfortable, getting their own way of doing it. And the questions are going to be seen by this person before the interview, because we want to make sure that we are respecting the space of the history, and we are respecting the way they want to tell the history, because it's truth, and as an interviewer, our perspective is important, and the way we are framing and the way we are constructing the oral history is important, but there are limits in the way the person wants to tell the story. And we, and especially in these type of situations when there is security issues in the middle, when there is human rights violations in the middle, we need to be really careful, and we need to be really careful with the fact that John is an American white guy who is interviewing someone from a country that used to be a country colonized by France. So that perspective needs to be taken into consideration when we ask questions and when we frame the project. And after John does the first one, then all the interviews are going to be between the community and are going to be in French. And we will know, we will deal with that when the time comes. But we give it back to the community. So that's planning the power dynamics is part of planning oral history, which includes how we interview and how we are interviewed.
One, typically, oral histories are the reflection upon the past, not the recording of a contemporary of the present. Right? They're not recording what is going on; they are exploring an individual's reflection upon the past. So they're usually not so close to the event. But that's not to say that recording these events isn't important; is not a form of justice-making work in and of itself. But it's a little outside of the purview of like an oral history would be. Kind of like the difference between a podcast recording a podcast interview, which has a kind of a, it's meeting a need in the current moment, which could be useful to future moments too. I would say recording, ensuring when events are happening within a congregation, to have representative documentation that includes everybody's experiences, that is done so with agency of everybody, is vitally important. So I think it's part of this idea of empowering memories. But it's a little more directly to the historical moment than an oral history normally would be.
Yeah, as a historian, I think that would be fabulous. And there's a variety of ways of capturing that. There's John's points, but also having multiple voices. So it's not just getting that one oral history. As we know, human beings, through time, their perspective and memories of how something happened can sometimes change. For those who do more ethnographic work, this is a big challenge. So my colleague, Mark Morrison Reed, who is one of the professors of history also at Meadville Lombard, he is working on a book on the empowerment controversy. And a lot of folks are still alive. And so getting the perspectives and, you know, here you have one voice and another, and they're contradicting each other. And so how, as a historian, that's part of the historian's work, is you work through that. But you want the multiple perspectives because of that. And that's one of the things, just as a minister, as a parish minister, part of why I was interested in going back for a PhD in history is there was a time of controversy in my congregation around a minister, and it was so fascinating about the different levels and of perspectives, and not even levels, but different viewpoints, standpoints, so to speak. And how it made it very complicated. And so actually I never did find out what exactly happened. But I had a larger sketch of that because I asked curious questions, because I listened. And I decided it wasn't important that I found out the truth necessarily, because I don't think I actually was going to ever find it. But having those multiple perspectives gave me guidance on how to think about it and talk about it with the congregation. But doing this important work, especially around racial justice and thinking about it as a congregation, amazingly important. And that's one of the things Mark Morrison Reed does, is have students record and recover, I should say, recover, and I do a version of this well, but he goes, as well, but he goes much deeper, is they recover the racial history of their congregations. And how many folks in leadership in founding congregations who are people of color and they are left out or off the historical record. And this is one of the examples of the erasure and the silencing that were part of this workshop, and so glad that you're all here to overcome that. So, yeah. We have time for one more question. I want to make sure if there's anyone else, though, who didn't get in, because Elizabeth. Okay, Elizabeth. Oh, there's one in the back. And Elizabeth, we'll get you in. Don't worry.
Yes, there are a variety of different ways to do it because there's different needs, but the Oral History Association does have some examples. And if you also go online, you'll see it. If you're working with an archive or a repository that does this a lot, they'll probably have a sample form for you to sign. Once again, the underlying principle, I know it sounds really boring and technical, but you want a researcher to really be able to use this and to quote it and to reproduce it in his or her scholarship. So to do that, it's really vital you have it signed over.
Elizabeth.
Yeah, Claudia, you mentioned examples of how you have to be really conscientious of privilege and bias and positions of power when you're doing an oral history interview, and I wanted to ask if you or any of the three of you had examples where you used more of a peer-to-peer, non-hierarchical partnership when creating oral history.
We did it with our international group 2 years ago. We was a workshop like today. And we asked them to pair between them. So it was one lay leader from, we had like six different students. So we had one lay leader from Transylvania, one minister from Transylvania with one minister from Indonesia coming together and sharing their experiences. So yeah, and those are different. As John said, and we need to recognize that. We need to be, there is not a right or wrong way of doing it. It's just, we need to be aware what is behind the interview and our objective.
And to close this out, I'm going to invite up the Reverend Dr. Lee Barker, president of Meadville Lombard Theological School, and he's going to tell you about a few more resources that we think you might like to know about.
Thank you, Nicole, and thank you to all of our presenters, Claudia, John, Nicole. You know, they represent and embody the passion, the expertise, and the joy of Meadville Lombard, and we really appreciate what you're doing for us. You know, great, yes, clap, please. My parents died many years ago, and shortly before they died, they had a friend who worked at a local university who was an oral biographer, and he decided that what he wanted to do was to, because he was sort of fascinated by my parents' lives, was to do an oral biography of each of them. And so each of them sat down with Professor Gower for about 3 or 4 hours, and he asked really insightful questions about their lives from beginning to that point at which the interview took place. There were many places on those tapes, which we, the children, inherited eventually, where my parents diverged in their memory of certain events. And my sisters and I, in the many, many years, and now our children and grandchildren, talk about not so much what happened, but how our parents saw what happened. And I want to say that those tapes have become an anchor in our own family understanding of who we are, in our identity, in our relationships, in the way that we are with one another. Those tapes have become foundational over the decades that we have had them. You know, Meadville Lombard kind of holds the family story of Unitarianism, Universalism, and Unitarian Universalism. And one of the reasons that we are so intent on collecting the stories of Unitarians and Universalists, Unitarian Universalists across the ages, is because those stories are the anchor that can hold us together culturally as a religious movement. And so we actually want to invite you and your colleagues around Unitarian Universalism to contribute your stories in to our archive. And we have a number of collections that might be of interest to you that you might think, that's a place for me to add my voice. We have our Sankofa collection, which holds the story of persons of color in Unitarian and Unitarian Universalism, and primarily African American, not exclusively. We also have our Cuentos collection, which holds the story of Spanish-speaking people in Unitarian Universalism. We have our religious education, Sophia Faz collection, which is a wealth of information and stories from people. Our international collection, our UUA congregational files. We have congregational files of the Unitarian Universalist Association from when it moved from 25 Beacon Street to its current location on Farnsworth. We have a humanist collection. And then, John, I wrote down my third thing. I know it, obviously, and I can't possibly read my own writing. What do you think that is? What's my next collection?
Her story.
Yeah, that's it. That's right. A collection of how women have become empowered, or not, in Unitarian Universalism over the years. So we invite you to be in touch with our archivist, John Leaker, who is, I want to say, the only living archivist in Unitarian Universalism working exclusively on Unitarian Universalist archives and who does such a great job for us. And we are so pleased that you are here today, but we also invite you, when you are in Chicago, give us a call, come and see these archives for yourself, and find a way to add your voice to them. We would be much, much appreciated, because that's your story in those archives. That's your story. Thanks, everybody. Hey.